Once upon a time, working as an election worker was a badge of honor, a commitment to democracy. Now, nobody wants the job. And now, here comes AI. From hanging chads to deepfake videos, American democracy wobbles in this episode of Lost in the Middle.
The New Hampshire primary was really pretty sleepy this year. Nikki Haley's long shot campaign was spinning its wheels like a car on a snowy road in Manchester. Other candidates were dropping out left and dropping out right. Joe Biden didn't set foot in the state until after he won the primary, his first visit in New Hampshire in more than 2 years. But along the way, he did make his presence felt in a weird robocall to voters just 2 days before the election, warning them not to vote in the primary, but to save their vote for the general election in the fall.
What a bunch of malarkey. We know the value of voting Democratic when our votes count. It's important that you save your vote for the November election.
The message clearly says, don't vote in the primary. Save your vote for the general election in the fall. It sounds like Joe Biden's voice, but it is not. It was an AI-generated fake message, and the impersonator is a New Orleans magician doing it on primitive off-the-shelf software.
My name is Paul Carpenter, 47-year-old, magician, hypnotist. I've been doing magic since the age of 10. I've been making social media content for clients, friends, for years.
And to create a voice on 11 Labs, you literally just add, like you want to create a new one. It says instant voice cloning.
Carpenter was paid $150 by a campaign consultant for Minnesota Democratic Congressman Dean Phillips' lonely presidential campaign. Look, he barely outpolled me, and I wasn't even on the ballot. Carpenter realized pretty quickly he could be in big trouble and tried to deflect the blame.
I created the gun. I didn't shoot it. And I'm not about to be blamed for somebody being stupid who's been in the industry for 20 years.
Only after this commercial showed up in the primary did the Federal Election Commission make this kind of impersonation a crime. The political consultant who was behind it said it was just a stunt to show how dangerous AI can be. Well, disinformation has long been a part of American politics. In recent history, take March 2020 and Texas's Super Tuesday, when robocalls falsely told voters they could still vote on Wednesday. And in 2004, flyers distributed in Ohio told voters that Republicans should vote on Tuesday and Democrats, well, they should vote on Wednesday. But the days of misleading flyers are now ancient history. AI has taken these slimy tactics to a new level. And what surprises me is that in some ways, we're behind the international curve. Here's a quick clip from a recent BBC story.
This isn't just a Western phenomenon, this is really global. And one that really springs to mind happened in India, where a BJP candidate, that's the ruling party, used a similar technology to essentially speak different regional dialects that he couldn't actually speak. And in this example, it wasn't disclosed clearly to the audience that this was AI generated. And when it emerged that it was, the actual BJP party disowned this use and kind of decried it as something that they didn't want. And then more recently in Indonesian elections that happened earlier this year, we saw an avatar of a synthetically resurrected, deceased previous leader coming back to endorse one of the candidates.
President Indonesia.
In the US, we haven't had resurrection and endorsement moments, at least that I'm aware of. But here's one clever use of AI, targeted at older Americans. When I was a kid, my parents would often eat lunch and listen to Chicago newsman Paul Harvey. His voice is instantly recognizable. He was an icon in rural America, and he recorded this homage back in 1978.
And on the eighth day, God looked down on his planned paradise and said, I need a caretaker. So God made a farmer. God said, I need somebody willing to get up before dawn, milk cows, work all day in the fields, milk cows again, eat supper, then go to town and stay past midnight at a meeting of the school board. So God made a farmer.
Paul Harvey died back in 2009, but here he is again this year. God created Trump.
And on June 14th, 1946, God looked down on his planned paradise and said, I need a caretaker. So God gave us Trump. God said, I need somebody willing to get up before dawn, fix this country, work all day, fight the Marxists, eat supper, then go to the Oval Office and stay past midnight at a meeting of the heads of state. So God made Trump.
NBC's Chuck Todd was the host of Meet the Press for nearly a decade.
I mean, look at the God Made a Farmer parody that Trump did with Paul Harvey. I mean, that was, you know, to people of a certain age, they're going to recognize that Paul Harvey voice. I mean, I certainly did. You know, I'm probably on the lower end of those that still remembered Paul Harvey. But, I mean, it was like, oh, my God. Like, you want to talk about a voice that is just so distinctive, right? Like, he had such a distinctive voice. I think that had a powerful effect on Trump's base.
We still haven't gotten our arms around how to regulate existing social media. And now, in an age of election conspiracy theories, artificial intelligence will throw jet fuel on a bonfire. Matt Wheel, the Bipartisan Policy Center.
Why we didn't get some of the craziness we got after 2016, 2020, because it was harder for people to connect with other like-minded conspiracists. I think social media has been very good to connect people who had trouble connecting in the past. And you know, without oxygen, some of these things die off. Now there's plenty of oxygen, and so the fire can rage.
I think, unfortunately, social media can have the tendency to exacerbate pre-existing divisions. And it does this in a number of different ways. So because it relies so heavily on personalized algorithms that show users content based on past behavior and preferences, it can create echo chambers or filter bubbles where users are exposed to content that reinforces existing beliefs. And this can have the effect of intensifying polarization.
Theodoros Giadis is the CEO of Tech Policy Consulting and an advisor to Microsoft and others.
And it also has the effect, unfortunately, of facilitating the spread of mis- and disinformation, because over social media, information that is inaccurate, whether it is unintentionally or intentionally inaccurate, can spread like wildfire.
And exactly, how do you put out that fire? It's not as easy as it sounds, since the two political parties stare at each other over a wide philosophical chasm. Katie Harbath has managed to straddle two often hostile worlds as a Republican staffer and a leader at Facebook, and now the chief global affairs officer at Duco, a tech policy consulting firm. But talking about the problem in the nation's capital and actually doing something is the same old story.
If you look at surveys amongst Democrats and Republicans, Democrats very much feel like they should, they're more, much more open to more content moderation, to more content being taken down. Republicans and people on the right tend to want more content up, protect freedom of speech more. And so these platforms are stuck in the middle where they can't really, they're kind of screwed either way of what they do. And there's these Supreme Court cases right now about whether or not what rights the platforms have for content moderation that have had a bit of a chilling effect for these platforms right now about what they can or cannot do.
And now, in the middle of all this, comes artificial intelligence. I should tell you that some critics point the fingers at the alarmists and say all of this hand-wringing is overblown. Look, people can tell when it's an AI image. The press can help us figure it out. But what happens if the press has the exact same issue? Here's longtime Meet the Press host Chuck Todd one more time on what happened when NBC hosted a Republican debate.
We tell people, be careful. They're doing these parody AI accounts that make you think it's NBC News, but it's not. So the Trump campaign did this parody using AI. And within 2 hours of one of our correspondents doing a voiceover, introducing the Republican debate. This was the one we hosted in Miami a couple months ago. And within 2 hours, they were up with a parody of what it sounded like our correspondent voicing over an introduction to the debate with suddenly some colorful language, attacking all the candidates, et cetera. So we tried to get them to take it down, and they said, oh, it's parody. We tried to get X to take it down. And they're like, you know, there's nothing we can do here. And, you know, we didn't, like I said, you know, we could have gone the, oh my God, can you believe what happened here? Well, then eventually people will just stop watching NBC News, right? They don't know what to trust. So it really puts us in a real box.
Federal and state regulators are trying to figure out how to prevent artificial intelligence campaign abuses, for example, requiring campaigns to disclose AI creation. But the reality is that if someone launches a deep fake ad on a Sunday night, right before the election on Tuesday, how do you stop it? In time? And who do they punish? The creator of the ad or the ad agency that placed it? Assuming, this is a big assumption, they can even identify the perpetrators. Chuck Todd, one more time.
We're in that worst part of a new technology stage where there's no regulation. So I do think that our elected officials are trying to meet the moment here. The question is, can it happen fast enough? Because the biggest thing I think we have to just get at, number one, is simply transparency that AI was used, right? That is step one in trying to get the public aware of this AI issue, is to proper label it, frankly. And that I think is the first thing we've got to focus on. Look, I actually think we're in such a precarious position of trust already, not just us in the media, but government officials, everybody, that it's very possible if we get this wrong, we will we could easily end up putting ourselves in a situation where we've almost become nihilists, where we don't believe anything.
It ends up so poisoning the information environment that nobody trusts anything, not even the facts. And that, of course, is what we don't want. That is, I mean, bad actors would love to see nothing more than a democratic country where nobody has any faith in anything anymore. If that's the way people are left feeling, then they're doing their job to undermine democracy.
Edward Perez cut his teeth at Twitter and is now a thought leader on the intersection of technology and elections. And he's a board member at the OSET Institute, whose mission is to rebuild public confidence in our voting system. He worries about the misuse of AI to disrupt the back room of every American precinct.
One of the most important things to understand about election administration is it's very, very process-oriented, and there's a tremendous number of layers. As I just suggested, are we talking about voter registration? Are we talking about creating the election? Are we talking about what goes on in the warehouse when we're configuring machines? Are we talking about all those poll workers and the long lines that you might see in the local news? Or are we talking about reporting? And it's critical to understand that part of the security of election administration is the fact that all of this technology is never deployed just in a vacuum.
Is this what you thought the business would be like when you signed up for it 10 years ago?
No.
That's Rob Rock, who runs elections for the state of Rhode Island.
No, and I think it's taken a number of changes. You know, the first major change was the cybersecurity marriage between elections and the tech world. And that was something that was completely, I never thought about it. And now all of a sudden, I have to become a tech expert. And by no means am I.
And on the other side of the country, Republican Idaho Secretary of State Phil McGrane says there's a real risk of the system being overwhelmed.
The ability to react at the pace of the technology that's being developed is almost impossible. Like, by design, our system is meant to be slow and methodical. And the pace that some of this is developing is so quick that it's not a matter of that it can't happen. It's can we imagine it quickly enough and to be able to respond? And also, ensure we want all the benefits, but we don't want the burdens. And that's a struggle with so many things. And this is a perfect example where there are some great utilities in this technology. And I think we will see that. There's just also some really serious risks that we have to be prepared for.
Here's Eddie again.
The idea of what generative AI can do is a little bit like phishing on steroids. It's a way that allows bad actors to reach out to potentially get their tentacles, so to speak, into all of these process-oriented areas in the elections back office, and those can pose new security threats.
But the reality is the U.S. election system has been wobbling for decades, and it was first knocked off balance by the recount in the Gore Bush campaign of 2000.
This podcast is brought to you by the American Property Owners Alliance. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that protects property owners and their interests. Did you know that in 10 states and Washington, D.C., the government can take more than what it is owed in property taxes in the instance of a foreclosure? From 2014 to 2021, 8,600 homes and more than $780 million in savings were lost to this practice known as home equity theft. We are working to end home equity theft everywhere it remains on the books. Visit PropertyOwnersAlliance.org to join the effort to protect property rights.
Keep in mind the U.S. election system is actually a conglomeration of 50 different states with 50 different voting rules, 132,000 polling places staffed by 775,000 volunteers. And that night, the entire election came down to just a single state. Florida. And stoking the nation's anxiety, network news stations made one flawed call after another.
A big call to make. CNN announces that we call Florida in the Al Gore column.
Turn the lights down. The party just got wilder.
Florida goes to Mr. Bush.
Bush wins. Headline of the hour. Folks, it might be premature.
So we take Florida away from George W. Bush.
This is no longer an election. This is like Alice in Wonderland.
As the news coverage pivoted back and forth, most Florida officials had no idea what was going on in the very wee hours of the morning. Some were likely trying to wind down with a slice of pizza and beer after an exhausting 48 hours. Others were dead to the world, like the Tampa area election chief, Kurt Browning.
If you are just waking up and just tuning in, you should know that after a long night of swing votes, the presidential race is frankly still too close to call.
On November 8th, Kurt Browning, the supervisor of elections for Pasco County, woke to shocking news.
The vote is now so close between them that there will be an automatic recount.
What are you talking about, recounts? I'm in bed. There's no recounts going on. And literally within 3 hours, we were in the throes of a recount.
So the entire presidential election came down to one state, and in reality, just several counties, and more precisely, precincts within those counties. But many of them had used different voting systems. The automated ones were a breeze, but the focus came down to old-fashioned punch cards. In those precincts, voters punched out tabs to signify their votes. But many ballots had what were called hanging chads, because the card had not been punched all the way through, and so a tiny edge of the paper still stayed attached. So was it valid or not? In the end, the Supreme Court halted the recount because there were no standards in place to evaluate the validity of disputed votes in four large counties. And so George Bush won the election with a 537-vote margin. In the wake of the Florida fiasco, Congress passed a huge bill to modernize U.S. election systems and provided millions of dollars to train election workers. And state legislatures passed a number of safeguards. But the fight over election reform drags on to this very day. Voter ID became a favorite of Republicans around the country in order to prevent fraud. Democrats said it would make it harder for poor people to vote who might not have a driver's license. Democrats pushed mail-in voting to make it easier. But Republicans countered with questions about verifying those votes. Since the 2000 cliffhanger, by any objective measure, the back room of U.S. elections is dramatically better. The Washington Bipartisan Policy Center has been at the forefront of pushing reforms.
You pre-2000, where you had lever voting machines and butterfly ballots and, you know, no way of easily recounting or challenging results. Our system now is paper-based. We have high-speed, highly accurate scanners. We have ways for people with disabilities to vote independently. We've focused on military voting to make that easier and to ensure they have enough time to vote. Our system has come a long way in 20 years, and yet still people think, well, this system doesn't work.
Then in 2020, the unthinkable happened. It all went to hell everywhere.
So we have to be very careful with the ballots. The ballots, that's a whole big scam. You know, they found, I understand, 8 ballots in a waste paper basket in some location. They found, it was reported in one of the newspapers that they found a lot of ballots in a river.
And suddenly, additional layers of security, like cameras in the tabulation center, which were supposed to make the counting more transparent, fueled calls of fraud, like the Zapruder film, every time someone moved a box or handed a piece of paper to someone else, every frame was analyzed and dissected. Here's Matt again from the Bipartisan Policy Center.
We had actually called for more cameras in the counting sites because we thought cameras, transparency, that can only be a good thing. What we realized is cameras are mostly a good thing, but without context, most people don't know what happens in the after election process. And so what the cameras became was a vector for misinformation. And now you had video, you know, quote, evidence of malfeasance, which wasn't that, but because the cameras were, you know, there's no commentator, it's not a play-by-play like a sporting event. So no one was explaining what was happening.
Video clips from election workers that were set up to give citizens confidence were now used to undermine it. Poll workers around the country, who were housewives, painters, insurance salesmen, and teachers' aides, who were once lauded for their services, now became villains in a nationwide plan to steal the election. Here's Rudy Giuliani attacking a mother and daughter poll worker pair who he accused of being at the heart of the attempt to steal the election in Georgia.
Ruby Freeman and Shay Freeman Morris and one other gentleman, quite obviously, surreptitiously passing around USB ports as if they are vials of heroin or cocaine.
At a later congressional hearing, the women pushed back in tears.
I no longer give out my business card. I don't transfer calls. I don't want anyone knowing my name.
They won a defamation case against Giuliani with damages of $148 million, which, incidentally, has still not been paid. It didn't matter if you lived in a red state or a blue state. The people who ran the elections and their families were harassed and in some cases threatened with violence. The Democrats didn't really have to try to rig the election in Rhode Island. Biden won by 110,000 votes, a margin north of 60%. But in Cranston, the state's second largest city, election officials still faced blistering attacks. Nick Lima runs the elections in that city.
It's completely changed. I mean, everything about our job has changed. Yeah, I still, to be honest, have a little PTSD from it, as do my coworkers and plenty of other election officials around the country. Yeah, I mean, it's something that everyone has dealt with in their own way. I can tell you that there are still times I wake up at night thinking about polling places and poll workers, and that's true for any job, right? I mean, any job where you have stress. And elections have always been a cycle where, you know, during election season, you really feel the pressure, you feel your heartbeat increasing a bit.
This is not an isolated example. In the last 2 years, half of the election officials in the country, half of them have quit. And the executives who stayed on for 2024 are starting with half of their workforce battered around from 2020 and the other half learning on the job with live ammo firing around them. But what about being a Republican Secretary of State in the era of election stealing rhetoric? Here it's the inverse of Rhode Island. Idaho voted 64% for Trump, but that's really not any different. Idaho Secretary of State Phil McGrane says in coffee shops and grocery stores, poll workers are confronted by election deniers, and he knows in November they're going to be out in force.
Just the act of standing behind you watching you work just puts you on edge. It doesn't matter whether it's your mother, your spouse, but definitely if it's a stranger, everyone has that natural inclination, like they want to do it right. And now you start second guessing yourself, even if you know you're doing it right. Let alone what we see is people asking questions. You know, poll workers are trained to help run the polling place and issue ballots properly, check people in. They don't know about cybersecurity on voting equipment and what testing went through, but you might have, your poll watcher asking these questions. That there's no possible way this poor person who's serving at the polls is going to be able to answer.
Katie Harbaugh believes the struggles to police social media have actually made everybody in the election universe better prepared for what's coming.
My mantra for this year is to panic responsibly. And so I think that as people are hearing the news about this or experiencing this or kind of going through all this, we should be worried, and it's good that we're asking these questions. And frankly, that's a part that I'm optimistic about, is that we're asking these questions earlier with AI than what we did on social media.
The elegant high-tech solutions are for the people who live in a universe of ones and zeros. But on the ground, there's a very real, different crisis. The election chaos has made it harder to find the basic building block of the system, the citizens who run the polls and count the ballots. You want to know why it's so hard to get poll workers? Talk to people who ref kids' sports. Years ago, I almost dropped my popcorn at a third grade basketball game when the mom of one of my son's teammates was so out of control she got tossed from the gym. These were 9-year-olds, for God's sakes, 9-year-olds. The parental abuse has led to a crisis in youth sports to find enough umpires and enough referees. Now think of the abuse in recent years heaped upon a 75-year-old retired librarian who volunteered to work as a poll worker. It's no wonder all around the country they've quit. But there's an intriguing solution to this issue, and you can find it in just one state, smack dab in the middle of the country, in Nebraska. Well, let's talk about how we can turn this climate of suspicion around, and at the same time, give every precinct in the U.S. enough poll workers to get the job done. Nebraska's the only state where counties can draft poll workers. Think of it as a variation on jury duty. Brian Cruz lives in Omaha.
But do most Nebraska voters even know this exists?
No. You know, that's the thing. Even a lot of my friends in that. In fact, a friend of mine, he's the COO of a lumber company here. I mean, we're together all the time, vacation together. And he called me about a week ago and he said, my employee got this letter for a draft. Is this a real thing? And I said, it sure is. And he said, can I get him out of it? And I said, nope. So no, I mean, a lot of people have no idea about it. In fact, we were doing poll worker training a few years ago, and the mayor of Omaha, her husband at the time, walked in and I said, Joe, what are you doing here? And he said, you sent me the damn letter.
If you get drafted, you have to work 4 elections, from school board to the U.S. Senate. This fall in Nebraska's Douglas County, about 45% of poll workers will be draftees. Aside from solving the manpower headache, it has an additional, very important benefit. Since many poll workers are oftentimes political junkie, this random selection process drags people into the process who are casual voters, less passionate about parties and platforms and candidates. And you want to try to rig an election? Try it when half of the room is only there because they face prosecution if they didn't show up.
But I was just out at a restaurant a couple weeks ago, and a guy randomly stopped by and said, hey, you know, thank you. You know, you run a nice office, good ship or whatever. And I always ask him, I said, now, were you drafted or were you a volunteer? And he said, no, I was drafted. And I said, well, hey, thanks, you know, appreciate it. And he said it was a great experience. He said, and that's what we hear most of the time is from most people is it's a great experience.
I've never been a poll worker, but back in 2013, I was an international election observer. I volunteered to serve in Iraq. It was the country's second parliamentary election after Saddam Hussein had been ousted. Insurgents were determined to depress turnout and derail its fragile democracy.
2 car bombs managed to make it through the heavily guarded Baghdad airport, where they went off just seconds apart. In the southern province of Nasiriyah, several people were injured when 2 separate car bombs went off in an industrial area north of the city. The bombings come just a few days before Iraqis are scheduled to vote in the country's first elections since the 2011 U.S. troop withdrawal. The upcoming election for local-level officials is being seen as a key test of security forces' ability to keep voters and the country safe.
The international community was determined to make the election a success. Our team of observers were sponsored by a program funded by the Canadian government. It was a pretty motley crew. Jim Slattery, a former Democratic congressman from Kansas, 2 former Canadian members of parliament, and 2 members of the European Union who had nothing in common except for spending a lot of time in perpetually rainy Brussels. One represented part of Stockholm and brandished a scruffy graying beard and a Free Palestine sticker on his suitcase. The other, a heavy-jowled British conservative with a pocket scarf in every blazer. We spent most of the days leading up to the election in the U.S. Embassy compound getting briefed on not election issues, but on security issues. Like, if your armored car drives over a roadside bomb, how would you respond? Yeah, lots of uplifting conversations. The morning of the election, we woke up to the sound of explosions in every direction. We held back for a while to get a read on what was going on outside our 10-foot walls. It turned out to be more bluster than a real threat. To discourage turnout, insurgents were blowing up balloons filled with gasoline. They paired us up in groups of two. I was paired with one of the Canadians who'd been a serious hockey player. The security forces had seen me kicking around the gym, more out of boredom than a commitment to fitness, but figured, hell, at least I could run 100 yards if I had to. It was a pretty low threshold to qualify. So I know you're thinking, what the hell has this to do with America's elections? Well, hang on with me for a minute. So the Canadian and me were sent to the more remote sites on the embassy's checklist. In the back with me was our Lebanese interpreter. She and I talked Middle Eastern food during the drive. I'm a sucker for lamb kebabs and hummus. And as we were pulling up to our first stop, she asked me if I'd ever had Iraqi bread. No, I replied. It was thicker and coarser, she explained, not like the kind of bread used to make pitas. Our election site was in an elementary school, and as I walked to the second floor where voters were checking in, it felt exactly like the kind of place I had voted in my entire life. The hallways were covered with pictures drawn by kids. People had to show their IDs and then press their index finger on an ink pad to make sure they didn't vote twice. Memo to self, suggest this to the city of Chicago. As I stood watching, my interpreter pulled on my arm and pointed to a plastic bag on the table stuffed with overflowing bread. The woman behind the counter asked her in Arabic what she was pointing at. The interpreter explained we had been talking about that kind of bread. Suddenly, there was a flurry of conversation around the table, and the poll workers lit up. It could have been in Wichita. Most of the poll workers here, like in the States, were elderly women who looked like they'd spent the last week baking for one another. In Wisconsin, it always looks to me like they eat one slice of banana bread for each ballot they hand out. Within 30 seconds in Baghdad, I was trying to balance bread, cheese, and olives they'd thrust into my arms, accompanied by warm smiles. So when people talk about election conspiracies in the States, it's hard to get that image of these poll workers out of my head, just like the poll workers I will see this fall in Wisconsin. I have a hard time seeing a vast conspiracy in the basement of my local Lutheran church. Let's keep in mind my checkered background. A journalist, a politician, a lobbyist, the entire axis of evil. Cynicism always comes easy to me, and I'm suspicious of the government, but I have a hard time seeing a seething cabal where I vote in November. In my corner of the world, I don't worry about election integrity. I worry about my waistline. Excuse me? Can I have one more piece of banana bread for the road? Here's the team behind Lost in the Middle. Executive producer Jeff Mayers. Producer Todd Elbaugh. Creative team Claudia Luz and Tony Wood. Edited by Aaron Zummers. Music by Brett William. Production at Civic Media. And a quick thanks to our partners at the American Property Owners Alliance. If you like this episode of Lost in the Middle, please remember to subscribe to our podcast. And if you enjoyed it, please tell your friends and pals.